morning.
Good morning.
For some reason, I don't know why, the office failed to make your 15, 20 pages of mandatory homework. This gives you a little respite. You might just be stuck reading the Bible or something. We're at Daniel chapter 9, and in the earlier parts of Daniel, we did two chapters a week, and that's probably a little ambitious for this more difficult section. So let's see how chapter 9 goes today. And as usual, you're most welcome to interrupt and contradict and raise objections to this material. Chapter 9 is probably, as far as Bible prophecy is concerned, one of the key pivotal chapters in the whole Bible. So if you understand the basic theme of this chapter, you'll be okay with a good deal of the prophetic passages of the Old and New Testament. In the first year of Darius, the son of Ahasuerus, of the lineage of the Medes, who was made king over the realm of the Chaldeans, in the first year of his reign, I, Daniel. Daniel now is going to be in his 80s. The Babylonian Empire has come and gone totally. The Medes and Persians are now ruling. Daniel, however, has a high place in the government of the Medes and Persians. He's been recognized as a great statesman, so they've given him a high job like a vice president or prime minister. And so he certainly enjoys status with the Medes and Persians, as he did throughout the whole time of the Babylonian Empire. And we're 1 year into the reign of Darius, who is the general over the district under Cyrus, the Persian. Daniel, in the first year of the reign, now that sets it at 538 B.C. We can probably agree on that. In the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, understood by the books the number of the years specified by the word of the Lord given through Jeremiah the prophet, that God would accomplish 70 years in the desolation of Jerusalem. In other words, Daniel is reading this, been reading this scroll of the prophet Jeremiah, who died probably some 40 years earlier, not long after the fall of Jerusalem, and he was taken to Egypt and martyred by his own countrymen. There are two places in the book of Jeremiah where Jeremiah very specifically says that the Jews would be out of the land for 70 years. In chapter 25, the specific number of 70 years is mentioned, and again in chapter 29. And chapter 29 is part of a letter that Jeremiah wrote to the captives. He sent it over to the captives and over to Ezekiel to warn the people not to listen to all the prophets that were running around rampant, to pay attention to God's representatives such as Ezekiel. And in that letter he sent over there, he mentions the 70-year captivity. Why were the Jews sent into captivity for 70 years? What was God extracting from them as penalty for their doing something wrong?
Idolatry?
No.
They didn't keep the Sabbath land on land.
We're not along the land to lie fallow.
Every seventh year, the land is to lie fallow and not be planted. Why is that? Any reason for that scientifically, or is that just a rule?
Recovery.
It allows the land to recover its fertility. Yes, that's right. And the Jews have failed to do that for 490 years. So God says, you owe me big time, so I'm going to collect on my Sabbath rest for the land. So I'm going to collect 70 years of forced rest on the land, and you guys are leaving the country. There are plenty of other reasons that God was angry with them. There's lots of them. Yeah.
So one big one, the child sacrifice involved in idolatry?
Oh, yes. All of the idolatry, the Canaanites had come in and on, but this is it. This is the specific punishment for their not living according to the fundamental rule of the land about the care of the land.
70 years.
Okay. Now, so Daniel is reading Jeremiah, the scroll of Jeremiah. He's prime minister. He could order these books through interlibrary loan or probably find them on the internet. But actually, these are big scrolls. And some of the captives, when some of the refugees would have brought them over. Jeremiah might have sent them over earlier, but anyway, he's got all of Jeremiah on a big scroll, and he reads it diligently, yeah.
Do you know if they ever really honored the Sabbath for the land, even after that?
No, I don't think they did. I think they didn't do it afterwards either. Now, so what Daniel sees is, oh, the 70 years is almost up. If you go back to 605 at the time that the Jews began to be taken and Daniel was taken, the clock is counting down, and where it looks like it's just about time for God to begin to allow the Jews to go back into the land. And that's what provokes this great prayer of Daniel here in chapter 9. So Daniel sees that 70 years is nearly up, and he says in verse 3, I set my face toward the Lord God. He always prays in the direction of Jerusalem, even though Jerusalem's been in ruin for 50 years now. He still prays in that direction as if Jerusalem was and the temple were intact, and as if the sacrifices were still going on, which they weren't. I set my face toward the Lord God to make requests by prayer and supplication with fasting, sackcloth, and ashes. I prayed to the Lord my God. The name of Yahweh is mentioned 7 times in this chapter, which is unusual. I prayed to the Lord my God and made confession and said, O Lord, great and awesome God, who keeps his covenant and mercy with those who love him and with those who keep his commandments. What covenant do you think he's thinking about here? Covenant with Abraham, most likely. Now look at this. There's nothing bad said about Daniel anywhere in the Bible. He's a godly man. You can't find any fault in him. None of the people in the land, the rulers, none of his enemies can find any fault in him whatsoever. As squeaky clean as anybody in the whole Bible. And look what he says. We have sinned and committed iniquity. We have done wickedly and rebelled, even by departing from your precepts and your judgments. So he includes himself along with all the people of his land and puts himself in the same class. Jeremiah did that too. So also Ezekiel was to make themselves one with their people and just take the responsibility for the failure of the nation upon himself. Neither have we heeded your servants, the prophets, who spoke in your name to our kings and our princes, to our fathers and all the people of the land. O Lord, righteousness belongs to you, but to us shame of face, as it is this day. Dismal failure throughout there. Embarrassment for not coming anywhere near close to being the people that you wanted us to be. You have driven... O Lord, righteousness belongs to you, but to us shame of face as it is this day. To the men of Judah, to the inhabitants in Jerusalem, and all Israel, those near and those far off, in the countries to which you have driven them, because of the unfaithfulness which they have committed against you. That's, he's always paying attention in his prayer to cause and effect. We did this, therefore God did that. You sent prophets to us and we ignored them, so God responded. So there's a very clear, he connects here the current situation with a series of track record of the failures of the people, both in Judah and Jerusalem and in the northern tribes. O Lord, to us belongs shame of face, to our kings, our princes, our fathers, because we've sinned against you. To the Lord our God belongs mercy and forgiveness, though we have rebelled against him. Calling attention to God's mercy rather than his justice, and his patience, the long-suffering, and his mercy, asking God to be merciful. We have not obeyed the voice of the Lord our God to walk in his laws, which he set before us by his servants, the prophets. Yes, all Israel has transgressed your law and has departed so as not to obey your voice. Therefore, the curse and the oath written in the law of Moses, the servant of God, have been poured out on us because we've sinned against him. What's the reference to the curse and the oath here in the law of Moses? Tail end of Deuteronomy in this covenant of the land that if you behave yourselves, you'll get blessing upon blessing and prosperity and health and in the land. And if you disobey the laws of living in the land, then curses will come upon you. That long list of cursing and blessing, the conditional right to live in the land. That's what he's saying. So he says, we blew it really big time ever since we've been in the land. Ever since Joshua brought us into the land. All of Israel had sinned. All of us. And God, verse 12, and God has confirmed his words, which he spoke against us and against our judges who judged us, by bringing upon us a great disaster under the whole heaven. Such never has been done as has been done to Jerusalem. So the prophets were announcing the impending destruction of Jerusalem centuries before it happened, and God finally got around to executing that relentlessly, ruthlessly, and it was a terrible, bloody destruction of Jerusalem. Unheard of, especially for God's people to go through that kind of a disaster. As it is written in the law of Moses, all this disaster has come upon us. Yet we have not made our prayer before the Lord our God that we might turn from our iniquities and understand your truth. During this whole time period with all these warnings and now with the destruction of Jerusalem, there has come no national repentance. The refugees out living in Babylon have gone about their secular business and not paid any attention to God. Daniel has. Daniel prays morning, noon, and night, but nobody else paying any attention. Therefore, the Lord has kept the disaster in mind and brought it upon us. The Lord our God is righteous in all the works which he does, though we have not obeyed his voice. How are you going to appeal to God when you've had nothing but failure and you haven't confessed that failure? And Daniel's pleading with God now to remember his promise about 70 years, but he can't bring a list of all the wonderful things the Jews have done, because there isn't any list like that. It doesn't exist. And now, O Lord our God, who brought your people out of the land of Egypt, that was unconditional, and that was gracious of you a long time ago. You brought the people out of the land of Egypt with a mighty hand. You made yourself a name, as it is this day. We have sinned, we have done wickedly. You brought us out of Egypt so we could represent you and be your representatives. We blew that one rather badly and failed in that. O Lord, according to your righteousness, I pray, let your anger and your fury be turned away from your holy city, Jerusalem, your holy mountain, which was caused because of our sins and the iniquities of our fathers. Jerusalem and your people have become a reproach to all who are around us. That is, Jerusalem's gotten a bad reputation, and God's people have also, and God's name has been besmirched by all this long-term disobedience. So this is all what Daniel's praying in this. Daniel himself is innocent and blameless, but he puts himself in with all the people. Now therefore, O God, hear the prayer of your servant and his supplications, and for the Lord's sake, cause your face to shine on your sanctuary, which is desolate. Your temple is your city, Jerusalem. They're currently desolate and broken down, and the 70 years is up, and would you now start the restoration process. O Lord, O my God, incline your ear and hear. Open your eyes and see our desolations and the city which is called by your name. We do not present our supplications before you because of our righteous deeds, but because of your great mercies. That's a wonderful way to come into the presence of God, not on the basis of all the things you've done or your track record or your abilities or anything that you've done. You go to God on the basis of that he's merciful and gracious. That's a wonderful prayer. It's one of the great prayers in the Bible. O Lord, hear. O Lord, forgive. O Lord, listen and act. Do not delay for your own sake, my God, for your city and your people are called by your name. Ray Edmond includes this in his list of great prayers in the Old Testament. Somehow the office forgot, or something went wrong, that all your notes didn't get done. I'll get them to you. We'll get them next week, because I included Ray's comments on this great prayer. It's a beautiful prayer, wonderful model prayer on praying not only about your own self, but about the people of God in and around your life. So that's Daniel's great prayer. While I was speaking and praying and confessing my sin, confessing his own sins and the sins of his people Israel, presenting my supplication before the Lord my God for the holy mountain my God. Notice how he just totally identifies himself with the failures of his own countrymen and his own people and makes himself one with them. That's kind of a good healthy thing, to not put yourself in a separate class of being holier than thou and to just be one of the people. He's in the middle of the prayer. And yes, verse 21, while I was speaking in prayer, the man, or the angel, Gabriel, whom I had seen earlier in vision, being caused to fly swiftly, reached me about the time of the evening sacrifice. The evening sacrifice in Jerusalem would have started about 3 p.m. had the temple been functioning, which it wasn't. And it would have lasted probably an hour, from 3 to 4 p.m. So Daniel makes it a habit to pray in the direction of Jerusalem every day at 3 p.m. And out on the balcony where everybody in Babylon was aware of that in his palace. Now we get this very strange event here that the angel Gabriel shows up at his side and says that he has been dispatched as part of the answer. Right in the middle of the prayer, God set Gabriel on his mission, and it took Gabriel a little while to get there, maybe an hour. It's kind of a little puzzling. God sends an angel, and the angel gets slowed down a little bit. He doesn't get there instantly. He gets there before Daniel's finished prayer. While I was speaking, the angel Gabriel, whom I'd seen in the vision, being caused to fly swiftly, reached me about the time of the evening offering, maybe sometime after 3 p.m. He informed me and talked with me and said, O Daniel, I've now come forth to give you skill to understand. At the beginning of your supplications, when you started to pray, the command went out from God for me to come to you. And I have come to tell you, you are greatly beloved. Therefore, consider the matter and understand the vision. So there's God immediately sending Angel Gabriel to go comfort and strengthen Daniel, who's obviously greatly moved by the realization it's time for the Jews to go back. And so the angel Gabriel comes to strengthen Daniel. Very interesting. A little interesting that there would be any time delay at all in an angel coming from the throne of God to Daniel. I don't know what warp speed that is or what. Next, chapter 10, we'll see some very interesting dynamics of what goes on with the angels and the connection of angelic activity with things going on earth. Now here's what Gabriel tells him. And this is a little cryptic and it's very important. 70 weeks are determined. 70 weeks are determined, during which the following six things will all take place. 70 weeks, 77s, that's always, the Jews have always understood that to be 70 sevens, 70 heptads, 70 weeks of years. 70 weeks of years are determined, and these 70 weeks apply to your people, Israel, and to your city, Jerusalem. Okay, so this is a long-term prophecy that applies to Jerusalem and to the Jews, and during this 77 weeks, the following things will happen. The following things will have happened. First of all, to finish the transgression, to make an end of sins, to make reconciliation for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy place. Okay, those six things. Now, if any of those happen, have some of them not happened, this is now, all the history of Israel will continue until all these six things are done and over with. Have some of them happen. How about the first one? To finish the transgression, that is, for the Jews to shape up and start obeying God and being the people that God intended them to be. Has that happened yet?
No.
How about to make an end of sins, for the human race at all to stop its sins and to go through judgment and to be obedient people thereafter? No. To make a reconciliation for iniquity. Yes, that's the death of Jesus for the sins of the whole world. That's happened. To bring in everlasting righteousness. Our wonderful world, you know, it's getting better every day. If you read in the news, we're getting less crime, less divorce, less murder, rape, pillaging. The world is getting rapidly better. Righteousness is coming in right now, don't you? No, I'm afraid not. To bring in everlasting righteousness. Well, that would be obviously the rule of the Messiah on the earth and righteous behavior of the world. That hasn't happened yet. To seal up vision and prophecy. That would be the all of vision, all the prophecies that apply to Israel, all the major Bible prophecies are fulfilled. Happened yet? No, not by a long way. To anoint the most holy place. That probably a temple in Jerusalem. There isn't any temple in Jerusalem now. We did Ezekiel a while back, remember? We had a temple in Ezekiel. That's probably the temple that gets anointed and sealed by the Messiah when he's back. Well then, there's a lot of unfinished history for Israel. Okay? Israel could not possibly be set aside from the plan of God. And the church has not replaced Israel, obviously. Or this part of Daniel would be not true, wouldn't be in our Bible. So this is the list of six things that have to happen during this total of 490 years. Now, it gets a little complicated here, and it's fun reading it. If you calculate the time scales, but let's look at it a little bit. Let's go through this step by step. Know, therefore, and understand that from the going forth of the command to restore and rebuild Jerusalem, up until the time the Messiah, Nagib, the Messiah, the Prince, comes, there will be 7 weeks plus 62 weeks. The streets of Jerusalem will be built again, and the wall, even in troublesome time. All right, now then, that says that after 69 of these weeks have passed by, the Messiah will have come. And we've got a clock counting here, and the clock starts with some kind of a royal decree from somebody that allows the Jews to go back and rebuild the city of Jerusalem. Well, there's four decrees that we can find in the book of Ezra and the book of Nehemiah that are some way related to the Jews going back to the land. There's a decree from Cyrus when the Medes and Persians begin their rule over the territory. Cyrus agrees that the Jews can go back to the land and rebuild their temple. And he sends a letter to the keeper of the royal forest authorizing them to draw in lumber and supplies for that. There's another decree a bit later by Darius, which affirms the first decree that the Jews have a right to finish and build their temple. The third decree is one by Artaxerxes, which says essentially something, but there's only one decree that has anything to do with the rebuilding of the walls, the moat, the city, and that's a decree by Artaxerxes Longimanus, the first, in 445. And Nehemiah chapter 2. Nehemiah, the cupmaker, the cupbearer of the king, the one that takes the king's wine to see if it's poisoned, is a good Jew, and he goes in, and Artaxerxes finds him depressed and discouraged and asks him why, and he says, well, I'm very concerned about my people, Israel, and Artaxerxes says, well, okay, you can go build the city walls. So the temple was finished and dedicated in 515 and functioning long before the walls of the city was ever built. But with the decree we're looking for here, what starts the clock counting, is the decree that says, go build the city. So this would say our clock starts 445, maybe 444 BC. That's when we start counting this 70 weeks. Now the 69 weeks is divided into 62 plus 7. I don't know quite why that's true. Nobody seems to be absolutely positive. It would seem that perhaps the first 7 weeks here, or 49 years, are to do with the rebuilding of Jerusalem, because the rebuilding of the wall was difficult, and was opposed, and wasn't easy, as you can see from the book of Nehemiah. Now we have that, after verse 26, after the 62 plus the 7 weeks, this is after the 69 weeks, Messiah will be cut off, but not for himself. The word cut off implies executed or suffered the death penalty. At the end of 69 weeks, the Messiah will suffer the death penalty, but not for himself. Didn't die for himself, died for the sins of the world. This leads to all kinds of attempts to count the number of days. Sir Robert Anderson from Scotland Yard in the 1800s did a detailed calculation to show that from 445 down to Palm Sunday, April 7th in the year 323 AD, amounts to 173,880 days. If you do calendar corrections in there, because the calendars have changed a little bit. And for some reason, it sort of seems to be a little arbitrary, all of the Bible scholars pretty much have decided that the year you use here is a 360-day year, which is called the Jewish prophetic year. Well, that Velikovsky believed that. Now, Velikovsky isn't the most reputable Bible scholar in the world, kind of an oddball guy, but the ancient calendars tended not to be 360 days. They tended to be 365, about like our days, or something like that. So you can't prove beyond a shadow of a doubt. I picked up Gleason Archer on this week on his commentary on Daniel, and he points out ancient calendars simply were not 360-day period. Some people have insisted that all the calendars in the world changed from 360 days to 365 days at a certain point in past history. I don't think that's provable. Nobody's come forward with anything that proves that most ancient calendars were 360 days long. If you take the 360 days, then you arrive at Palm Sunday, pretty much, from the decree of Artaxerxes in 445 till Jesus rode into Jerusalem on a donkey on Palm Sunday, would be 69 years, right to the day. And Jesus on Palm Sunday came into Jerusalem as the legitimate heir to the throne of David and was executed a few days later. If you want 365 days in the year, then you can do your own set of calculations, you'll come up with a slightly different answer, but you'll still come into the frame, right time frame, general time frame for the arrival of Jesus on the scene of history. Okay, so everybody's pretty well agreed that 69 weeks from the start of this clock running takes you down to the execution of Jesus on the cross. That's the clock. Now we've got one more week. After the 62 plus 7 weeks, Messiah will be cut off, but not for himself. Then the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. Okay, Jerusalem is going to be destroyed by the people of the prince who is to come. Now, what happened in history that might fit that? Destruction of Jerusalem by Titus, the son of Vespasian, who besieged the city and destroyed Jerusalem on the 9th of Av in the year AD 70. It'd be about 40 years after the death of Christ on the cross, approximately. The people of the prince who is to come. Now these people then, the people that destroyed the city, we have no doubt are the Romans. Right? The Roman army that came in. And Josephus, remember, Josephus gives an account of this. It's very vivid and lucid. And Titus came in, fairly humanitarian, tried to stop the destruction of the city and plead with the Jews. And they were all fighting with one another, and the siege went on long, long months, and people starved and resisted, and they could have surrendered and made it much easier for themselves, but the city was leveled. He will destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end of it will be with a flood, and until the end of the war, desolations are determined. A little cryptic there, that's a little... Till the end of what war and what kind of desolations? Until the Messiah comes back, Jerusalem will be subject to foreign domination, will be subject to wars and fightings and destruction. Well, the subsequent history of Jerusalem since AD 70 is like that. The Bar Kokhba revolt, was that 135? The Jews revolted against the Romans, and the Romans cracked down and drove them out. And there was a time period when the Jews were thrown out of the land altogether, and Jerusalem was plowed under and renamed Aeolia Capitolini, and there was all traces of the Jews were removed from the city. And there's all those times of then a Muslim conquest by the Arabs and the Turks and the Mamelukes, and all the way down to the present. Jerusalem's had this troubled history, with no real strong national sovereignty, all the way down to the end. Middle East is still a cauldron. So this time period is still going. Now, so the Messiah will be cut off. An invading army of Romans will destroy the city and the sanctuary. And the troubles of Jerusalem will continue all the way down to the end of the age. Now, verse 27. Then he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. Who is the he here? We have to look back to the look back to the previous antecedent here of he. Who is this he?
Prince.
The prince. The people of the prince who is to come. The prince who is to come then is going to be Roman. Roman ruler, the Roman political leader that we met a couple of chapters ago in Daniel. The little horn of Daniel 7 was that. A bad guy will confirm a covenant with many, with the many, for 1 week. The 1 week, 7 years. The many being Israel. In the middle of the week, he, the prince, the Roman prince, will bring an end to sacrifice and offering. What sacrifice? What offering? What temple? Isn't any temple in Jerusalem? Well, there must evidently then be a temple in Jerusalem when this all comes to pass, a functioning temple with animal sacrifices. And the Jews have plans to build such a temple even now. I think there's 400 some priests have already been trained, Levitical priests are trained, and most of the sacred vessels are already there, already built, and once you can build the temple, the Jews are set to put this temple together and get it functioning again. And what this passage tells us is that this Roman great leader will make a covenant with Israel for 7 years. There's another bad guy in here during this time period that we ran on to a couple chapters ago. We have the Roman bad guy, the political, economic, Western world ruler in league with the Jewish false Messiah, who we saw was like Antiochus Epiphanes, was like that. Antiochus Epiphanes was the Syrian ruler who came down in 175 and desecrated the temple and stopped the sacrifices and killed a whole bunch of people and took the temple treasures and offered a pig on the altar. And Jesus spoke about this man in the Olivet Discourse, telling the Jews that there would come a day when a desolating sacrilege spoken of by Daniel the prophet would go into the temple in Jerusalem. And if you're living in Jerusalem when that happens, get out of town quick, because then all hell's going to break loose on Jerusalem yet one more time, and it wouldn't be a good idea for you believers, you people who believe in me, to be there in town. All right, so now the scenario here is that there's going to be a peace treaty in the Middle East, and it's going to be orchestrated by this ruler from the Western world. This federation of Western world nations is going to come in and make some kind of a peace treaty in the Middle East in cooperation with this Jewish false Messiah. What do you suppose that peace, that treaty will be all about? What do you suppose, how would you, if you're going to write that today, what would you do?
Peace.
Some kind of Middle Eastern peace process. You've got to make everybody happy with the existence of Israel, with a temple in Jerusalem, with secure borders for Israel, for rights for the Arabs, for end of terrorism. How are you going to enforce this?
World government's
government's going to enforce this, because this is the survival of mankind is at stake. Because if we have another war, it'll destroy the planet. And so this has got to be enforced economically and militarily. And this Western Confederation, the world government, has the military political clout to hold this covenant in place by force. Except, this covenant is, what's wrong with this covenant? What's wrong with the Jews making this kind of a peace treaty?
It's not
the kind of covenants they're supposed to make. They're supposed to get their strength from God. And their security and safety is supposed to come from God. And so they have no business getting into this covenant, which Isaiah says is Israel's covenant with death, or covenant with Sheol, or with hell. Isaiah uses pretty strong language for the, how totally faulty this covenant is, this agreement is.
So the covenant gets makes everybody happy for 3.5 years. It looks like at long last we're going to have some kind of world peace.
World peace in the Middle East, some kind of prosperity, some kind of a global government, good global control over the economy.
Is it really global, or is it still just the remnants from the Roman Empire, or does the Asian people get involved?
Yeah, this is debatable, because ordinarily the nations in Bible prophecy are those nations immediately in and around Israel. The Roman Empire surrounded the whole Mediterranean, but they certainly didn't rule all four corners of the world.
This last beast that represents the revived Roman Empire may very well have territorial control over the whole world. Did I mention the Club of Rome has drawn up a plan in which the world, the whole world, is to be divided into 10 administrative districts? In which case, then, this final one-world government could spring out of the Roman Empire, and every last person on Earth be in one of these administrative districts. That's possible. It's fairly probable. I think it does suggest a one-world government here. This last of these four great beasts is a great and terrible beast, unlike all the other beasts. It suggests a very strong worldwide rule over all of mankind. So. Now, what happens in the middle of the week that goes, what goes wrong in the middle of the week that breaks this covenant? This Jewish Messiah into Jerusalem goes into the temple of Jerusalem and announces that he's God and commands all the people to give their allegiance to the bad guy in Rome, in the Roman Empire, and he puts an idol up in the temple and commands the worship of the first beast of this bad political ruler. Pretty much a desecration of the temple, of what would be called the third temple in Jerusalem. Then what happens? He stops the sacrifices and offerings, and on the wing of abominations shall be one who makes desolate. There's the desolator of the, it's like Antiochus Epiphanes, a greater Antiochus Epiphanes, who desecrates the temple in Jerusalem, breaks the covenant, this peace treaty totally. On the wing of abomination shall be one who makes desolate, until the consummation which is determined has been poured out on the desolator. How, anybody want to add to what that's all about? What happens to these two bad guys? Here they get there, and who deals with them directly? Jesus deals with them directly on his return. All the armies of the world gather up at Megiddo and fight against one another and turn to fight against God, and the leader of the world empire and his armies are gathered up there, and Jesus steps into the scene and slays them with the breath of his coming. What happens to this false Messiah in Jerusalem? He gets slain in the same way by just the word of God directly, the direct words of Jesus to him.
So, you
said that he in 27 refers to the ruler. Doesn't it refer to the anointed one? Because Christ puts an end to sacrifice. Right? Well, you have to look and see what the word he refers back to what person.
Yeah, so that you said look for the...
The previous antecedent is Prince in verse 26.
But it 26. Also talks in 26 about the anointed one.
Verse 26, the Messiah will be cut off, but not for himself. The people of the prince who is to come will do the following things. And then he, the prince who is to come. There's an awful lot of the commentators would take that, the covenant maker in verse 27 to be Jesus. There is no, Jesus didn't make any covenant like this, however, historically. Yeah.
Plus, when you read on, and you get to stand on the wing of the temple, he will set up an abomination.
That's Jesus wouldn't set up an abomination. Yeah, he, this prince, will set up an abomination, will set up this idol in the temple in Jerusalem. That's when you're exposed. So this is the day that man declares himself to be God, and takes over the world rule. And notice that it's kind of concise language. What we get here is one of the puzzling features of Old Testament prophecy. You get what's called the great parenthesis, which is something that appears about 24 times in the Old Testament. A big break where the historical record will go along and suddenly stop, and when it picks up again, you've jumped into the far distant future. A great parenthesis. And what is in that great parenthesis? The whole history of the church. So the 70 weeks of Daniel is very interesting, because 69 of these weeks went on right on by until Jesus died on the cross. The clock stops. We've waited 2,000 years for one last week to grind out. It's very strange.
Where does the Bible say that the 69th week or the 70th week stops then? I mean, you say this, I understand what you're saying, but where does the Bible say that?
It doesn't say it.
It doesn't say it.
So you have to decide that's in the implied in the text. This is tricky chapter here, and you get a whole wide range of commentaries on this. Some good and some not so good. Yeah.
Yeah, it just seems kind of strange that the church has been sitting here with bated breath since they've been reading these passages, and it would seem that there would be, I mean, it's like, it's not going to be a secret if a treaty gets made instituting peace in the Middle East, there can be a lot of folks running around with major red flags, assuming they're here. It's kind of like we're reading in advance, and a lot of people are saying, "Yeah, we can see this possibility." But right, it just seems kind of strange that there's no, obviously there wouldn't be a voice of outcry raised here, but maybe those that would be doing the outcrying aren't here. I don't know.
What's been the history in the Middle East of the last 30, 40 years, 50 years? One peace proposal after another.
At any price, yeah.
And this whole thing, issue of dividing the land for a price has been around 20, 30 years now, in which the Jews would give up a piece of their land in exchange for peace. And right now, Prime Minister Sharon is arbitrarily giving up Gaza, pulling out of Gaza with the hopes that that will appease the Palestinians and stop the terrorism, which probably won't.
The roadmap.
The roadmap, yeah. The Oslo Accord, all of these things start up and get everybody enthused.
In verse 27, where it says, you know, make a firm covenant with him, it carries the idea of really enforcing it. So it's
yes.
More of an enforcement of the covenant.
Yeah, strong. It's a strong covenant. It's a
which we've never had before, really, in any of the peace
agreements. That's right. It's got to be backed up by some kind of consensus. Now, the peace treaties that have been proposed, you tend to get, the world tends to be divided. Europe and the United States will take different positions on one of these peace agreements, and the Jews are divided against it. Yeah.
There's also talk of Israel joining the European Union.
Yeah. Which that causes a big fuss. But President of France said this weekend that it would be better if the Balfour Agreement had never been made in the first place. The Balfour Agreement was the agreement that let the Jews have a homeland.